This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our first session on the window of susceptibility that represents in utero exposure. Our first speaker is Dr. Suzanne Fenton, who earned her master's and doctorate degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the endocrinology and reproductive physiology program, working in the areas of artificial insemination and mammary gland biology. Her postdoctoral studies were at UNC in Chapel Hill and focused on the roles and gene regulation of epidermal growth factor receptor ligands in the mammary gland. Dr. Fenton was a research biologist at US EPA's Reproductive Toxicology Division from 1998 to 2009. In October of 2009, she joined the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences. Dr. Fenton recently served on the working group of the Breast Cancer and Environment Research Centers, and she represents the National Toxicology Program at the congressionally mandated Interagency Breast Cancer and Environment Research Coordinating Committee. She's the recipient of many awards at NIEHS, and this year was awarded NIEHS Paper of the Year. Dr. Fenton.
So Linda introduced you to many of the concepts that I'm going to talk about, so I'm going to talk about some of the introductory material quickly. As I'm the first speaker in this session, and because we're covering an important critical period in the life stage of in utero exposure, I wanted to introduce the entire session, so we're going to start with that. Linda alluded to the Barker hypothesis. This was an idea formulated a couple of decades ago. Sometimes it's called thrifty phenotype or fetal programming hypothesis. Really what it means is that the maternal environment, which when this idea was developed meant undernutrition, maternal stress, famine is exactly how it started, can lead to a variety of conditions in later life, but they all start in the womb, and it depends on what mom's exposed to. So this just illustrates the idea that during critical periods in early fetal development, there can be persistent changes in the body's structure and function caused by environmental stimuli in the offspring. We now call this developmental origins of adult disease, DOHAD, fetal basis of adult disease, FEBAD. There's a couple of different names for it, but it means the same thing. It means that environment and lifestyle participate with heritable factors during the time of pregnancy to cause potentially lifelong influences on the health and viability of the offspring. Some of the sensitive life stages are also called many names. So I want to talk about a little bit about that because you're going to hear these terms throughout the day today. They can be called critical periods, critical windows, susceptible subpopulations, life stage susceptibility, windows of vulnerability, sensitive life stages. There are many names. What they mean is there are sensitive, critical periods of time in development when environmental influences may have a more powerful or sensitive effect on the tissues or the developing organism. What makes them more sensitive is many things. So the developing child has an immature gut system. It doesn't absorb things like you do as an adult. It has an underdeveloped immune system. The neurological system is not fully developed at birth. The reproductive system certainly isn't developed until after puberty. Many of the enzymatic processing systems that we as adults have, infants do not have. So their absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion of a chemical insult can't be handled the same way we would handle it. Also, the rapidly dividing cells in many of the tissues in the body cause these windows of susceptibility. They are targets for defects in DNA replication, and the blood-brain barrier also is not fully formed at birth. So things that would not normally be able to get to the brain can get to the brain in an underdeveloped child. And last but not least on this list, and there's many more things that you could mention here, is the fact that the blood volume is lower in a child. So if a child is exposed to the same exposure we as an adult are exposed to, they may have a higher body burden because of the lower blood volume that it can circulate in. So this whole concept of fetal basis of adult disease has been recognized in the breast development and disease field, and there are many reasons for that. Myself and many people in this room have contributed to the knowledge base that has formed this description here. So during gestation, we know that the mammary gland begins to form, the mammary bud forms, and there's an initial branching that takes place in the gland. In early life, after birth, there's a development of the epithelium. It continues to grow into this fat pad that's formed under the layer of the skin. Terminal end buds, which are critical structures in the gland that are very sensitive to insult, chemical insult, are formed during this time, and they divide very rapidly. And that begins just prior to puberty, but then during puberty, you have an exponential growth of the gland that takes place. During this time, the terminal end buds differentiate, which is a really important process in puberty. The length of time that terminal end buds are present will make a difference in the susceptibility to breast cancer over a person's lifetime. Pregnancy and lactation, again, is another time of rapid development of the gland, and it's also undergoing maturation at that time. So you're shifting from a process of rapid growth to a time of differentiation and important function. If the growth didn't take place properly, then the differentiation and secretion of milk may not take place either, as Linda alluded to, that many women can't lactate who want to. And then, again, during adulthood, there's a senescence that takes place, a reduction in the lobular portions of the gland that become very immature and respond differently to hormones than they did prior to that time. So all of this taken together shows you that there are some really important times or critical periods in mammary gland development that we're going to be talking about today. I'm going to skip this because you all know now that 1 in 8 women are affected by breast cancer, but the important part is at the bottom of this picture. Environment and lifestyle are really the major portions of what we have in our life that may be modifying breast cancer risk. And I want to specifically talk about endocrine disruptors. So what are endocrine disrupting compounds? They are exogenous agents, meaning they're something from outside of your body that interfere with the production, the release, the transport, metabolism, binding, action, or elimination of a natural hormonal process in your body that's needed for normal development or homeostasis. So that means it doesn't have to just inhibit a receptor from binding to its natural ligand. There are many ways that chemicals can be endocrine disruptors. And specifically for the breast, this is important because there's not one or two hormones that affect the breast. There are many, and they're shown here on this picture. So all of these are endocrine pathways that are important for normal breast development and function and must be considered in looking at endocrine disruptors that affect breast cancer risk. So at the bottom of this slide, you can see there are like 85,000 plus chemicals on the open market today. Did anybody know that? A lot of people know that, right? Well, so did you also know that there's only about 20 on this list that we know of that have been evaluated for effects on breast cancer risk and that we know something about? The National Toxicology Program tests many chemicals for carcinogen action, and we've recently implemented some new methodology that will allow us to look at susceptibility and not just carcinogenic action, so something that might make the breast more susceptible to cancer over a lifetime. So some of these chemicals have been shown to increase carcinogenesis in rodent models. And also, some of them have been evaluated with other reproductive outcomes. So within a study, multiple reproductive outcomes may have been evaluated, like the uterine and ovarian response in addition to the mammary response and puberty. In those studies, the ones that have the asterisks, the mammary gland has actually been shown to be the most sensitive tissue in those studies. So, for example, genistein, in a multi-generational study that took place with the ATSDR and the NTP, we found that genistein was actually causing mammary gland changes in male rats at the lowest level of any of the tissue responses that they detected. So it was a sensitive outcome. And Linda forgot to talk about dioxin in her last talk, but I got it here, so I got you covered. Dioxin's a really important endocrine disruptor. It is also a carcinogen. As you can see at the bottom, it is classified as a carcinogen by almost everyone who classifies carcinogens. We know it's a bad actor. But when it comes to the breast, it is also endocrine disruptor. So if you don't know a lot about dioxins, they're pollutants. They're not something that's made generally. It's caused by combustion of plastics and such, and it is a pollutant in the air, and we all have it in our bodies. But dioxins are a family of compounds that include dibenzofurans, biphenyls, naphthalenes. They're brominated or chlorinated, and they can be mixed. They bind to the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, and they have a long half-life, and they bioaccumulate in fat. There is a common spectrum of responses that we're not really going to talk about today, because I want to talk specifically about the effect on mammary tissue. Our lab, together with Linda's lab, have evaluated critical windows of exposure for dioxin that affect the mammary gland development. We know that exposure during the time of breast bud development, so if we gave a single exposure of dioxin to animals on day 15 of pregnancy, of a 21-day pregnancy in a rat. So about 6 or 7 days before birth, they had one exposure. During the time of breast bud development, we saw on postnatal day 4, which is shown on the left, and postnatal day 25, which is about the time of weaning, on the right, that compared to controls, the animals that were exposed on gestation day 15 had more significant of effect of a delay in development than did any of the other time points when we gave dioxin. So we gave dioxin on gestation day 20, postnatal day 1, 5, 10, etc. But only those at the time of breast bud development were critical for the delayed developmental effect that persisted over the animal's lifetime. In addition to that, dioxin also affects lactation. So in this study in mice, so the last study was in rats, and now we have mice, and we gave animals dioxin on postnatal day 1 and 7 of their pregnancy, and then evaluated the mom's lactational development, the mammary gland development, over the period of pregnancy. As you can see on the left-hand side, the vehicle, the right-hand side is dioxin-treated. As early as 2 days later, after the second exposure, we could already see that we weren't developing lobules in the system. And by day 17, you can really see a dramatic difference in the density of lobulovelar tissue that was developed in that gland. And this led to abnormalities in mammary gland that were so severe that the offspring died in this study. But the important point here is, in the animals that weren't pregnant, we also gave them dioxin at the same time points. And as you can see on the far right side, there's a comparison there of vehicle and TCD-treated animals that were not pregnant. They are adults. There was no difference. We could see no difference in the mammary gland development between those two groups of animals. So if exposed as an adult, not undergoing a critical period of development, no change whatsoever. Critical period of development, we see changes in not only the mom, but we also see changes in the offspring and in the second generation after that. And the important point here is that this isn't just happening in rodents. We're seeing these sort of changes in humans also. So in the top part, you can see that the development of the mammary gland is also been detected as related to dioxin exposure in girls. So both in the Netherlands, which is the Lees publication, and Den Haan covered the Seveso cohort of people that were exposed during a explosion event. There were girls that were at the highest levels of dioxin exposure, had stunted mammary gland development. So one of these was in an area that was accidentally polluted. One of these is in an area that's where the natural pollution level is no different than here probably. And the people with the highest levels of dioxin had the most stunted breast development. In breast cancer risk, there are several examples. The German occupational workers are more apt to have breast cancer develop in females, and a very recent update on this showed a 23-year mortality follow-up of 400 women occupationally exposed in a pesticide plant that contains dioxin have a very high level of breast cancer mortality, twice that of their unexposed cohorts. In other areas of Russia and Italy, there is an increase, at least a twofold increase, in breast cancer risk in women with the highest dioxin exposures. Lactation is also impaired in PCB dioxin-exposed women. So this is probably the best example that we have of translational interpretation of the data across animals and humans. It really suggests that dioxin probably affects the breast in an adverse way over their lifetime. PFOA, or perfluorooctanoic acid, is a compound that's studied both in my lab and within this BCERT program by Sandy Haslam and her colleagues. It's one of many perfluoroalkyl acids. These are used as surfactants since the 1950s, produced by 3M, DuPont, Dow, BASF. Several companies produce these compounds. They're used in the production of fluorotelomers, like in Teflon-coated pans, Gore-Tex products, Scotch guarding. Anything that's greaseproof or waterproof has this kind of coating on it. It's also used as a friction reducer in electrical wiring. It's a final C8, or PFOA, is a final breakdown product, and it's very stable in our bodies. Every single person in this room has it in their body, and it's not readily metabolized. The C8 science panel is a group of people who are being paid to investigate the health effects of these compounds by DuPont from a court battle. They have found probable links to several health outcomes in the group of people in Ohio and West Virginia who were accidentally exposed to this compound, and you can see those here. They just released their most recent one that looked at high cholesterol levels. Causes hypertension in pregnant women and thyroid disease. But one of the things that it does also is it causes delays in mammary gland development when given during gestation. So here is the work of Sally White, and this is a little bit complicated, so I'm going to walk you through it a little bit. If you look at the top row, it's the control animals. That's what the mammary gland should look like at weaning, in just after puberty, and in early adulthood. So those are the three time points I'm showing you. If you look at the very bottom row, that's 5 mg/kg of oral exposure to these animals during gestation only. So during pregnancy, the mom was exposed orally to this compound. We gave it to them. You can see the difference in mammary gland development. If you look at the top row and the bottom row, is substantial. So in this strain of mouse, we see significant permanent delays in mammary gland development. If you look at the middle row, that's 1 mg/kg of PFOA. A lot less drastic of an effect, but it's also permanent over the lifetime of those animals. What we did is we gave them, if you look at the second row, we gave them 5 parts per billion, which is just higher than what the people in West Virginia and Ohio had in their water supply. We also affected their mammary gland development in those animals by giving that to them in their water. In another experiment, we looked at mammary gland development at very low levels. So we're giving them now less than 1 mg/kg PFOA, but we're giving it to them during a critical window. We're just going from gestation day 10 to gestation day 17 in the mouse, which is a day before pregnancy in the mouse. And so if you look at the first row on the table and the developmental scoring, we actually look at several endpoints in the development of the gland, and we score the severity of effect, just like a pathologist would do in scoring pathology in the clinical lab. So we found significant effects of PFOA based on all of the developmental patterns that we saw. We could also quantitate several of the endpoints, and you can see here anything with an asterisk on it was significantly inhibited by PFOA. But so at 0.01 milligrams per kilogram, which correlates to some very important numbers. So if you can look in the red boxes, at 0.01 milligrams per kilogram, by the time we've weaned these animals, their body burdens, what they have inside them, is similar to what the children, or actually lower, than what children in the Ohio River Valley had in their blood. So you can see that we are very relevant here in terms of what people are exposed to, and even in some of our higher dose groups, by the time that early adulthood came around, the levels in the bodies of those animals were similar to what the children are exposed to in these areas. Now, I want to come full circle, because this isn't just about the mammary gland. Like Linda said earlier, there's a lot of things that are affected. There are risk factors for breast cancer that are also affected by this compound. So if you can see on the left-hand side, those animals were from our studies. The one on the left, the fat one, is the one that had PFOA while it was in utero. The one on the right is the one that was a control animal. In terms of uterine growth, we can also see over a very short treatment period that the uterine growth is altered in these animals. We see advanced breast disease as the animals age. So in the breast disease section there, those are 18-month-old animals. And you can see that the stromal section of that mammary gland has actually formed a stromal hyperplasia at this point, very out of control development. And we have this effect on lactation. So it doesn't just affect these. It affects many other things, such as pubertal timing, liver disease, Leydig cell tumors in males, in rats, and metabolic endpoints, such as insulin and leptin concentrations. So one of the important parts of this is that when we gave this compound to adult animals, we saw none of these changes. This is a developmental effect. So in adults, we don't see these changes, and that is really important. So it brings home the overall effects of these critical life stages, how important they are, and you're going to hear a lot of more exciting things about that today. And thank you for your attention. This is our PFOA team.
Thank you, Sue, for a talk that's very relevant to much of the work that's being done in the breast cancer environment research programs. Our second speaker is Dr. Shukmay Ho. Dr. Ho is internationally recognized for her expertise in the role of hormones and endocrine disruptors on disease development, including tumor genesis of the prostate, ovary, endometrium, and breast. Her current research extends to developmental bases of disease susceptibility by applying epigenetics to epidemiological studies, addressing two of the important challenges of research in environmental exposure and human health. Those challenges being multiple exposures at various developmental stages and also the transgenerational effects of exposure. Her recent findings on endocrine disruptor exposure, including bisphenol A, raised concerns about in utero exposure to endocrine disruptors in food and drinking water. Dr. Ho is a member of the Integration Panel of the Department of Defense Congressionally Directed Prostate Cancer Research Program and is on the Emerging Science Committee of the National Academy of Science. Her work has contributed to the recently passed Toxic Toy Bill in California and the reexamination of the risk of bisphenol A by the National Toxicology Program. Dr. Ho also serves as the director of the NIEHS-funded Center for Environmental Genetics at the University of Cincinnati and the director of the Genomic Microarray Lab at the university. Dr. Ho.
So what I like to do is to really bring up this fact. And we can see that, for example, in one generation, the Asian American immigrants from Asia has very low breast cancer risk. And then with each generation, their breast cancer risk increases. And we can clearly see that basically their obesity is also increases within the second generation. So many of these perhaps is related, not just related to genetics, but perhaps with other factors such as the environment. And we know that collectively, 35% of cancer is actually being able to be modified or changed by diet. Now, we are addressing this particular window. I just want to point it out, but we don't forget that all these are the other windows that we have to really be looking at. So let me just give you the hypothesis for this particular BSRP-funded program. It's not on prostate cancer, but it's on breast cancer. And what we're looking at is a very complex situation where we're looking at dietary fat in combination with a bisphenol A, which is a common endocrine disruptor, and how they impact the growing fetus in a transplacental way. So it is based on studies that were done by Dr. Lena Clark, and basically looking at, like for example, the corn oil, very high levels of corn oil, will really increase the early onset of puberty, and also increase what we call a carcinogen-induced mammary tumor. That was published in 1997, and also recently, Dr. Jose Russo, who is actually in the room, actually have this study showing that the post-conception oral gavage of bisphenol A, 250 microgram per kilogram body weight, will shift this chemical-induced window from day 50 to day 100. That means delaying it, and it will also increase tumor incidence, but there's no change in the onset of puberty. So in our study, we want to combine these two and ask a very complex question of what is happening with the dietary fat and also the bisphenol A combination. And we're going to examine a couple of things, including, for example, epigenetics and also hormonal levels, as well as some of these cytokines that is released by, that is regulating appetite and obesity. And the most important thing is we want to examine both the developmental breast here and later on what is going to happen to the breast cancer risk. So the experimental design is relatively simple. So the exposure is actually, these are the groups. One group have actually what we call a very, very clean, like no estrogenic diet, no phytoestrogen diet throughout life. And then all the mothers are actually exposed to high fat. These are the groups. And under this high fat, we use butter, which is quite complex. And it's cultural, too. It's cultural to this Western diet. And under that, we have like different doses of bisphenol A, and they're in microgram per kilogram body weight. And you can see that what the reference dose for U.S. EPA is at this dose, so we are franking it. And not only that, after this, we are actually acclimating the animal, the moms, prior to conception to these kind of diets. And then later on at the day 50, we will be actually putting a chemical to induce cancer and look at the tumors that are developed. So, but during the time of lactation, the mothers are actually back on the AIN diet, which has no estrogenic levels. Now, in order to achieve this kind of low dose, we have to really be very careful to have a highly controlled bisphenol A-free environment. And you can see that all these are the precautionary steps that we had taken to make sure that all the animals are not exposed, because we know all of us, that 95% of us here sitting in this room are already have bisphenol A in our body. So in order to make us really ensure that the control animals are very clean, they really have to use all this highly controlled bisphenol A-free environment. These are the findings, and I'm going to go through them relatively quickly. The first one that is actually interesting is that the maternal exposure does not affect the body weight or the food intake of the female offspring except for this particular group. And notice that this group is 25 microgram per kilogram body weight of bisphenol A is actually tenfold lower than the U.S. FDA U.S. EPA recommended dose. So this is one of the dose that I want you to notice. Now, then following that, we look at what happened to the leptins here and also for the adipoleptins. and actually give you an idea of like what leptins will do. Leptins will rise with more fat content in the body, and it actually acts as a negative regulator for body weight. So these are the changes we're seeing very, very early, very low doses in very low dose level. Now, there is no change in estrogen, circulating estrogen, nor progesterone, or any changes in the ovarian or the uterine weight. So that's just to give us some sort of like background here. But what is most exciting and interesting to me is that this high-fat butter diet in combination with bisphenol A at very low dose, you can see this is extremely low dose, only is like increasing or delaying the vaginal opening, which is used to usually measure sexual maturation, by 2 days. So this is pretty significant. And this seems to be a very marked effect. And we're going to come back to that. And this is in actually agreement with Dr. Susan Pinney's reporting of peripheral chemicals associated with lower BMI, which we showed you earlier on, delay the onset of puberty, and also Gail Windham found PCB and also PBDE delaying puberty, and Susan Tannenbaum reporting that phthalate and BMI did not affect sexual maturation except at the highest BMI group, in which one of the phthalate was associated with delay onset of puberty. So the other interesting fact is that we are seeing that it actually also affects the epithelial breast, epithelial density. Epithelial cells are the cells that are susceptible to cancer. So the dose that is effective is 250 microgram per body gram per kilogram body weight. And what is also interesting here, going back to this low dose, only these particular two low doses here we're seeing is actually going to affect the target of carcinogen later on. And these targets are these little buds here at the very, very end. You can see they're called terminal end buds. And these are the cells that are highly susceptible to any kind of later life carcinogens. And we can see that the dose we're seeing is actually really like an inverted U shape here. And there's no change in lateral buds as well as any number of branching points. Now, this is very dramatic. This dose, in combination of the high-fat butter, also affects the incidence of the number of animals that would develop breast tumors. And as you can see, this is the AIN diet. The high fat, surprisingly, is actually lowering. There are fewer animals that are actually developed tumors. But I'll tell you something, that the high fat is not that great. But at this point, the number of animals that would develop tumor is depending on whether their moms are given high fat or not. But comparing to this high-fat butter group, we can see that if we add bisphenol A on it, 90% of the animals will actually get tumor developed versus the other groups that gets about 60% of them would develop tumor. Now, let's look at other parameters here. And where are the tumors locating? This is also very exciting. If you look at a rat, and you can see that these are the thoracic glands. These are the abdominal glands. And the majority, although we see a total increase, like an inverted U-shape here, if we separate the number of where the locations are, we see that the most important one is that the tumor multiplicity, that means the number of tumor developed in per animal, is actually more in the thoracic thoracic regions, which is mimicking some of the local distribution of human tumors, where we have the four quadrants of the breast and certain areas are more susceptible to it. And this is really exciting. There's no significant changes in tumor latency. I just want to show you this diagram. But what is interesting is that the tumor developed in the high-fat group alone. Like, this is coming back. We thought that the high-fat group was very, very good because we have fewer sort of animal developing tumors. But if those tumors appear in the high fat group, this is shocking because the tumor grows so much faster than the rest of the group. So that gives us a very, very alarming fact. And in fact, the complexity is that the bisphenol A addition to it actually will bring it back to the AIN diet. So this is something that we can figure out at this point, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention. And there's wonderful information here. The contradiction is that now you look at the real effect is more dramatic in the abdominal tumors. So it shifts the location. So that's why we in human cancers, breast cancers, there's so many different forms. Now, let's look at cell proliferation. This is the cell proliferation. It mimics what we're seeing. This is the AIN diet. When you have high fat, it has lower proliferation, mimicking the lower incidence when we put high fat to the, give high fat to the moms. But at the same time, if we give bisphenol A a very low dose, it will push it back up into the high level that we see in the AIN diet. So that's one thing. Now, what about estrogen receptor alpha? It's different from what we just heard about the dioxin. It's actually dramatically increased. You can see the high fat versus the one that high fat plus the bisphenol A at a very low level, like 25 microgram per kilogram body weight, is the dramatic increase. And this is done by counting ER-alpha positive cells per eosinite by immunostaining. So it's at the protein level. Painstakingly counting, this is ER-beta, no differences. So we also look at two DNA damage markers. One is the 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine, and this 8-oxy-DG is actually a marker for oxidative stress damage. The second one is the 0,6-methylguanine, which is a marker for any alkylating agents damaging. We can see that they are really heavily localized on all these highly proliferative developing terminal embryos. Now, finally, I cannot excuse myself for not talking about epigenetics. So basically, I want to make a simple story about epigenetics, if I can point to it. We can see all this DNA, is double-stranded DNA is wrapping around a little proteins, and those proteins are called histone 1 to histone 4. And we can add a methyl group to the DNA, or we can add all this post-translational modification to the histone groups. And by doing so, we can actually make the chromatin condense into very tight chromatin like this, or make the chromatin relax like this open configuration. And if a gene is localized in the open configuration, the gene can be transcribed and expressed and have a phenotype. If the gene is trapped here in this dense chromatin, then the gene cannot be transcribed. Now, what we have done is we finished this work already, but I won't show you because of the time. We finished all this what we call transcriptionally regulatory histone marks. These are two groups, activation marks and also repressed marks. When we are marking them with activation marks, that means that region is actually open. When we have all these repressed marks, then the region is closed. So actually, you can see that we finished all this, and there is no difference. Now, what is different is one of the marks that very few people look at, and this is the histone 4K20 methyl 1 mark, and it is only happening in the high-fat butter plus the bisphenol A 25 microgram per kilogram body weight group. This particular mark is increased, and it turns out that this mark has a very general overall chromatin Y of effect in impairing the genome integrity and also programmed DNA rearrangement. So that means it makes the entire DNA unstable. And then in the making right now, what we have done is genome-wide mapping of all the DNA methylation sites, and we also are looking at ER-alpha and also the O-methyl guanine transferase, whether it's methylated or not. And then we are also in the process of looking at the genome-wide nucleosome positioning. That means we want to know what these little balls, we call nucleosomes, are located, whether they open or close, and whether that makes a difference. So that's what we're trying to do. And this will be my almost final slide, is the working hypothesis here as a conclusion. We want to ask the question of whether local versus systemic estrogen, we already ruled out, is going to affect estrogen receptor alpha and promoting proliferations and giving rise to oxidative stress and other opportunities for the cell to actually DNA damage. And if the damage is not repaired, they will perhaps lay down some primary DNA sequences changes. The second thing we're looking at is how epigenetic is coming in. Without the primary DNA changes, what is happening? Are the chromatin being reorganized in a global or in a microscopic and local environment level? And both of those processes are going to be affecting the risk of breast cancer later on to incels in the adult life. So the hypothesis is that the prolonged puberty that is caused by the high fat butter and bisphenol A certain level is actually going to increase the epithelial cell proliferation, epithelial cell density, allowing a longer time for DNA damage and also epigenetic remodeling of the chromatin, leading to integrity destabilization. Okay, so with that, I can tell you there are three ways of doing it. You're skiing down here, you're skiing down here, and if you have a combination, you have a different course. And these are these are my recognitions of all the group here, but most importantly, I want to recognize my community partner, and they are the Pink Ribbon Girls, and they will give some of the exciting works that we take the lead and we collectively have done together. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Shukame, for telling us about two exposures in combination and the effects we see. So Dr. Shauna Swan is professor and vice chair for research and mentoring at the Department of Preventive Medicine, Mount Sinai School of Medicine. She's recognized for her work on the impact of environmental exposures on male and female reproductive health. Dr. Swan has extensive experience conducting studies on the effects of a wide range of environmental agents, including organic solvents, water disinfection products, byproducts, pesticides, and plasticizers, on effects like time to pregnancy and infertility, adverse pregnancy outcomes, semen quality, steroid hormones, and gender-related physical and behavioral development. Since 1998, Dr. Swan has been examining the reproductive health and development of children in relation to prenatal and early child exposure to chemicals found in the environment, including phthalates and bisphenol A, in two ongoing multicenter pregnancy cohort studies. Dr. Swan.
Thank you for inviting me. And I'm like the token male. I'm going to talk about male endpoints. So this will be totally different. I hope what I'm going to talk to you about will have maybe some relevance to your work. I don't work in breast cancer, but I think some of the lessons may translate into your work. So what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to talk just briefly about phthalates and particularly what is called the phthalate syndrome. And then I'm going to talk about an endpoint that most of you are probably not familiar with, anogenital distance. I'm going to define it and give just a brief history. And I'm going to talk about why it's important. And this is one of the messages I want to give you, that this marker, which is measurable at birth, is actually a bridge between the fetal hormonal environment and the hormonal milieu of the fetal environment, and later reproductive function. So this is a very unique, perhaps useful way to go from fetal basis to adult disease. And I think that looking for, I guess that's my, Looking for these bridges is one of the things I want to challenge you to do. I've thought about what it would be for breast cancer. I can't tell you that. But I think that finding bridges of the kind that I'm going to show you will be pretty interesting. And then I'll talk a little bit about critical windows for reproductive system development. So we're talking about a different system. We're talking about a different gender, sex, and different endpoints. So, you know, you can just relax and... it's kind of like the comedy act that comes between the series. Okay. So phthalates. The phthalates that we found are most concerning are DEHP, diethyl hexyl phthalate, which is primarily found in food. It's actually, here's one source, and even organic milk contains phthalates because of this exposure. DHP is also found in the hospital setting, in any plastic tubing. Neonates in the NICU get very high exposures. The other chemical phthalate of particular concern is dibutyl phthalate in PVC, in cosmetics. It's actually not the primary phthalate in cosmetics, but it's the one that's most concerning. So when I talk about phthalates in this talk, I'm going to be talking about those and possibly butyl benzyl phthalate, which is also, like these two, anti-androgenic, which is their considered to be their primary mode of action. Although I have to say that the trade-off between being estrogenic and anti-androgenic is getting that borderline, you know, is getting a little... amorphous now, and I'm wondering whether we should make that distinction at all. So now I'd like to talk about the phthalate syndrome. Starting in about the early 2000s, toxicologists began to put together some results they were seeing on the male rodent. And what they found was that a whole cluster of endpoints were affected by, at that time, very high levels of exposure to the most anti-androgenic phthalates. DHP and DBP are the best studied. And what they saw was that there were this cluster of changes, but the most dramatic and the one that turned out to be the most interesting for me and for human studies is the reduction of the anogenital distance. So this is a marker that I've spent a lot of time with and very interested in, and maybe I can interest you in it. It's actually relevant for females as well. In addition to the reduction of the anogenital distance, which I'll define, the rodents that are exposed in utero to diethyl hexyl phthalate or dibutyl phthalate or benzyl butyl phthalate show malformations internally, which we can't look at in humans very easily, epididymis, vas deferens, and so on. But there are the other external changes. They are the male genital tract defects, hypospadias, and undescended testicles. And in rodents, there's nipple retention, which is a very strong endpoint. That, unfortunately, is not translatable because we're not litter-bearing animals. So that's not considered a human endpoint. So together, these symptoms have, or marks, if you will, have been considered the phthalate syndrome. These were defined, this syndrome was defined in rodents at about the time that I had the opportunity to ask the question, what are phthalates doing in humans? So what is anogenital distance? It's the distance from the anus to the genitals, as the name implies. It's actually a term that if you look in Urban Dictionary, you'll find a lot of street names for it, and some of you might know some of those, but it's not... is not totally new. It's actually not new to kids on the street, and it's also not new to toxicologists. It's usually measured in newborn rodents, and in rodents it's very simple. There's one measurement. In humans, there are a lot of alternatives that are confusing us, and we're trying to figure out the best one or ones of these to measure. It does increase with body size and age, but very critically to this whole day's discussion, it seems to be a permanent marker. That is, if you adjust for body size, if you're short at birth in your AGD, you'll be short as an adult. And here's a graph showing that in rodents. there's a very good correlation between your birth AGD and your adult AGD. Now, here's the kicker. We don't know in humans. No one has ever taken a measurement in a baby's AGD and followed that person until they were adult to see if that's true in adults. So this is an underlying assumption that we have to make when we talk about this as a bridge. However, we are looking in a number of studies now to look at least repeat measurements over several years, several times in, say, sperm donors and so on. So we're trying to get as much information on that as we can. But that's a really important question. How permanent is AGD? So in most non-human mammals, AGD is longer in males than females, about 1.5 to 2 times. Not entirely. For example, the hyena, it's reversed. But in most mammals. So the male AGD is supposed to be longer. And when it's shorter, it does correlate with impaired fertility and other changes. And when the female AGD is longer in rodents, that female is actually less desirable and has smaller litters. And there's some evidence from looking at same-sex and opposite-sex twins that the same thing is true in humans. You can ask me that in a question if you want to know about that study. So AGD is not new. In fact, I found a paper from 1912 that talked about how long the male and female AGD was in rodents. So it's about 100 years old, or possibly older. In 77, it was called the most objective criterion for sexing rats, and that's what's done in a laboratory. Very important for this discussion, in the 80s, Fred von Saal and others started looking at intrauterine position and shown that that affects the AGD. And so I want to spend a little time on that because I think it's very important. So here is some rodents in a uterine horn. And you can see they're close. And they get hormones from their mother. They make hormones, and they get it from their neighbor. And it turns out that the difference in hormone levels in these pups is actually measurable and makes a difference in their development. So schematically, we can talk about the 2M female, that's a pink female between two blue males, or conversely. And it turns out that you can measure, as I say, the hormones. Here's just testosterone. If you go all the way to the left, you see the most female. That's a female between two females. And if you go all the way to the right, you see the most male. Okay, male between two males. And there's a huge difference in testosterone. And even within females, there's a very large difference, and in males, there's a large difference. The increase in females is actually bigger, so the intrauterine position effect in females is somewhat greater than in males. If you look at the ratio of TDE, testosterone to estradiol, you'll see an even bigger difference. So I actually think that may be the most important parameters to look at. So does this matter? Yes, it does. So the 2M females... most male females are less attractive to males in rodent studies. They have more aggressive behavior, they have lower fertility, and they have a longer anogenital distance. Now, we're talking about differences in steroids that are a couple of drops in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Very, very small differences make differences in the AGD and in behavior. And the converse is also true for males between two females. But what about people? So I decided to ask this question because I had the opportunity. I had done a study in which we enrolled, it wasn't a pregnancy cohort study, we had enrolled couples and got their urine for most of them in early pregnancy. And so we had the opportunity to ask the children to come back measure phthalates in the prenatal urines of the parents. And so the children who were born in 2000 to 2003, and if the mother had stored a urine, they were eligible to be in our study. So here are the two measures of AGD that we took in the children. And I'm just going to refer to them as the long and the short AGD. This is the male. There's a comparable measure in the females. And I think you can see that it's not rocket science. It's not that difficult. It's not that easy, particularly if the baby's kicking. And by the way, we have standardized these methods. We have training videos. We will even send you a trainer if you help with if you pay for the the airfare, because we now have about 10,000 babies measured around the world, and we're putting that data together to get normative values on AGD. But this is how we started. So what we did in our study, and this is an interesting question of translating a toxicology study to a human study, and I call it human toxicology, we wanted to say, well, if we were looking for this phthalate syndrome in humans, what would we look for? Because nobody had done it. There had been some measures, actually two studies on AGD published before this. Nobody had looked at it in relation to prenatal exposure. And so what we did was we took these AGD measurements that I showed you. We measured penile width. We got a measure of testicular descent. And we related that to the phthalate metabolite levels in the prenatal urine. And I have so little time, I could spend the whole time easily talking about this study, of course. But what I'm just going to show you is a little snapshot. So this is taking one phthalate metabolite, MEHHP, it's a secondary metabolite of DEHP, and I'm also just going to show you the results categorizing the endpoint and the exposure. So if you categorize MEHHP into low, medium, and high, using those were the percentiles, and by the way, they were comparable to the NHANES percentiles. Then we categorized the children into short and not short AGD. And by the way, this was just based on those kids we had, 100 and something boys. We don't really know what short means. We hope to know that when we look at our 10,000 international measurements. But what we found in this data was that if the mother had a high exposure to MEHHP, and not very high, the top 25% of what's in everybody's body, compared to the low MEHHP, that her boy was 13 times greater chance of having a short AGD. And so what short means is controlling for body size and age. Using our internal standards, it was in the short 25% of our group. And if she had a medium AGD compared to MEHHP compared to low, it was about five times as likely to have a short AGD. So, and the girls were not affected, and all the DHP metabolites showed similar associations, and we also saw associations with DBP metabolites. And what else? So we also found associated with DHP decreased testicular descent, smaller width of the penis, and reduced scrotal size. We didn't see any hypospadias, but obviously the sample size was too small. So we feel that we did see, at least preliminarily in a very small sample, an analog of the rodent phthalate syndrome in humans. Okay? And so I guess this lesson here is, how do you take a toxicological syndrome and map it onto human endpoints so that you can look for those results and translate them from toxicology to, or animal toxicology to human toxicology. Now, a lot of people said, so what? Who cares if AGD is a little bit shorter? And so I'm going to give you a little few results on why short AGD matters in boys, and just mention something in girls too. So two studies looked at AGD in cryptorchid and hypospadic boys and found that there was a shorter AGD in boys with these genital abnormalities. And in rodents, short AGD predicts low sperm count and problems with fertility. And so we asked, is AGD related to semen parameters and fertility in humans? And these are the results of a study in which we looked at that. And just briefly, what we did was we enrolled college students in Rochester, New York, and we measured AGD, and we also got semen samples and got their sperm count. And what we found was, pretty surprisingly, that there was a very significant association between all semen parameters and the boy's AGD, a young man's AGD. But it was the shorter of these two measures. And interestingly, it was more significant with the shorter of these two measures. And interestingly, I didn't tell you that, but the measures for which we found the association between phthalates and baby's AGD was in the longer. So we're still trying to deal with those questions. Which one is right, or what do they tell us something different? And just to show you how this looks, here are the two measures. The one on the left is the anoscrotal, which is the shorter, and the one on the right is the anopenile. I actually showed you pictures of both of these in the photos. And you can see that they're both related, but the significant one is the shorter. And Michael Eisenberg at Stanford now did a study about the same time in couples coming in to an infertility clinic. He measured their AGD, and he got the sperm count. And he found that infertile men had shorter AGD, and he found similar results with sperm count. And he's also shown that testosterone is associated with AGD and testicular volume. So it does look like adult AGD corresponds to function in males. And if, in fact, that adult AGD corresponds to a childhood or birth AGD and reflects the hormonal milieu in utero, then we have this bridge that I'm aiming for, and I think we all are aiming for. So finally, I just want to say a few things on critical windows of exposure, because that's the topic of this, today's discussion, and I also think it's interesting. There's some prenatal data in animals and humans, and we've talked about that. There's actually more in humans. It's not totally consistent, but there's very little data on early postnatal exposure, nursing, early childhood, no pubertal data, limited data in adults, and no data on old age. So I just want to stress that the androgen in the critical window is what differentiates the undifferentiated reproductive tract and sends it on a path to becoming male. So the default is female, and androgen present makes the male phenotype. And if that is not there, or if there's not enough, then that path is not complete. So a female should not see much androgen at that time, and the male has to see enough. When is that? Well, several people have looked at trying to tease out the exact days prenatally in rodents that this occurs, and it appears to be gestational day 16 to 18, maybe 19 to 20, depending on the species, depending on what the chemical is. But that seems to be about when it's happening that you have to influence the androgen, decrease androgen in order to alter anogenital distance. How about humans? Well, much harder, isn't it? We can't do what they did in these experiments, you know, give pregnant women a phthalate on these days and not on these days and these days. And that's how they did it, right? Can't do that. So we have much broader brushstrokes. But I want to refer you here to a very valuable resource on critical windows, and that's from TEDx. If you don't know this, write this down. It is a very, very valuable website, TEDx Critical Windows of Development. And it's live. You can interact with it. And each of those little triangles that you see there, you can put your mouse, hover your mouse pointer over it. It will tell you what the endpoint is and the reference for it. So this is really useful, I think. And this is Theo Colburn's one of her contributions. But in humans, Paul Fowler did something very elegant. He took abortuses and showed that the AGD is diverging between males and females already by week 10. So the critical period for this differentiation is going to be before week 10 in humans. However, the exposures that we're looking at are habitual. Phthalate exposures, bisphenol A exposures, a lot of the things in our body are going to be habitual. So knowing the particular day is important mechanistically, it's important for the rodent studies, it's not so critical for us. So we shouldn't be too upset that we can't find it, right? Russ Hauser, in his nice study on repeated phthalate measures, said that a single urine sample was moderately predictive of each subject's exposure over 3 months. So we're trying to get now the right trimester at least. And that's what we and other studies are doing, trying to at least find out how that matters in development. I just want to say that there are multiple endpoints associated with prenatal exposure, not just reproductive, also gestational age, neurodevelopment, all have to be replicated. And other exposure windows, lactational, one study, male serum hormones, and several phthalates in breast milk. In childhood, there have been multiple studies. There's quite a few studies on childhood exposure, mostly related to asthma and allergy and also neurodevelopment. And there are also studies in adulthood on semen quality, which are kind of mixed in results, serum hormones, metabolic syndrome, pulmonary function, and thyroid function. But given the extent of exposure and the toxicity of these chemicals, this is a very small set of studies, and we really need to do a lot more. So in conclusion, prenatal exposure is undoubtedly most critical. The trimester may matter. Not clear yet. With chronic exposure, the timing is not so critical. Infant exposure is a critical gap. All these legislation that controls children's toys, we don't actually know whether that poses a risk. We don't have any data on, child being exposed postnatally in, infancy, what that does. In humans, and very little in animals. And in adults, there appears to be less critical exposure, as we've heard from other studies. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Ms. Benita Bailey. Ms. Bailey is a breast cancer survivor who was diagnosed first at the age of 29 when her daughter was only 3 years old. She had a second diagnosis at the age of 36. She works full-time as a registered nurse for a group of neurosurgeons in Cincinnati. She has been involved with the Pink Ribbon Girls, an advocacy and support group for for women survivors of breast cancer who were diagnosed at a young age, diagnosed before age 40. Currently, she's the outreach coordinator for this group and works to raise awareness of the special issues, fears, and concerns with being diagnosed at a young age. Earlier this year, Benita was honored with the Cancer Family Cares 2012 Jocelyn Haggard-Yeiser Unsung Hero Award. Today, she's here to tell you about an amazing survey that she and her colleague, Tracy Metzger, have done of over 700 young adults, assessing their knowledge or their awareness of early developmental exposures and their effects on adult health.
Thank you, Dr. Penny. And just so you know, I'm 43. I gave a lot of numbers as far as when I was diagnosed, but currently I'm 43 and loving life, so that's great. But again, just briefly, as far as with Pink Ribbon Girls, really we do a lot of education and outreach and really trying to help the woman as they're diagnosed going through treatments with meals, housekeeping, transportation, if you need babysitting. So this is kind of a passion of Tracy and mine to really kind of help, again, education and that age group. So we already have an educational program, which is called Love Your Girls, literally and figuratively. Again, we want to make sure that they're paying attention to all aspects of their life. So this kind of was a natural fit for us as far as our passion, looking at epigenetics and how we can now raise awareness in that particular age group, focusing on the younger adult and teens. So at this point, not being a scientist and not really knowing the terminology of where you get started, so we have received great and wonderful support from all of those colleagues at Cincinnati, Cincinnati Children's, Dr. Bureau, Dr. Penny, you know, helping as far as epidemiology, and Dr. Ho and everyone at UC has just been great. So that's kind of, you know, establishing, you know, guidelines, where we go. We've been meeting monthly since, you know, the beginning. So for a couple years now, we've been going over monthly as far as, you know, where do we start? How do we get this going? And really kind of looked at this needs assessment. Like, this is the best place for us to really kind of get some background information, looking at our community, what they do know, because, again, as Dr. Birnbaum said, how much scientific literacy is out there, and where do we go based on what we have, and how can we move forward? So looking at our survey, we were able to get two developed our IRB-approved surveys, one for adolescents and one for adults, looking at particular questions. The questions are were similar, again, just giving it a different point of reference as you were an adolescent versus an adult perspective. So we took a 60-day window of time and just said, this is when we're going to start and this is when we're going to end, and whatever we get is what we get. You know, we didn't want to do this for a very extended period of time because we're a very active organization in our community, so we have events going perpetually. It's not that it's just October. We're busy year-round. So getting surveys and passing out information, working health fairs, whether we're in Harlan County, you know, Kentucky, doing underserved, or in an African-American community looking at, you know, the schools or, you know, different football games, basketball games, volleyball games, you know, we're just out there all the time doing stuff. So that's why it was like 60 days and let's move on. So this is kind of a sample of our questions. So as it's kind of already been talked about today, you know, again, since our Dr. Ho's research is on the high-fat diet and looking at dietary issues, we really wanted to kind of capture that question and look at, you know, what happens with the mother, but also capture the father's effect. And as I think it's been identified that, again, not understanding how the father impacts the child and then the grandchild's health. So we've kind of tried to capture that with our dietary questions, and then looking at known health factors, you know, looking at smoking, looking at drinking. These are definitely known health issues that, you know, again, what does that mean in relationship to epigenetics, and does that epigenetic effect get understood to know what it is for your child and for your grandchild? So those are some of the categories that we looked at, and then, again, you know, 9 and 10 are kind of our genetics versus epigenetic questions. I think, you know, again, we already have kind of brought up the issue of identical twins and understanding that we do not have the same healthcare risk, but I think that kind of, you know, between question 9 and is, do I, you know, if you know that I get breast cancer, or my daughter get breast cancer as well, you know, again, that there's a big difference with that question. You know, you get 91% that got that question correct, but if you ask identical twins, you know, do they have the same breast cancer risk, and we're down at 39%. So again, that scientific knowledge is not there based on, you know, risk of disease and exposures and all of those kind of things. So this was really a wonderful learning opportunity for me, just understanding science and how you can translate that to kind of gather information as far as what people really truly understand. And again, I'm going to go to question 3 when we talk about the father's effect. You know, again, it's that, you know, very little people understand that fathers do have a huge role in their, you know, child's health. So I think that's really something too when we're looking at outreach, making sure that we're educating on all of those elements. So, you know, again, this is, you know, kind of where we started, how we gathered our data. You know, now we're going through and almost finished with the analysis, so we'll hopefully get very close to publication with that. So as I'd mentioned, you know, question 9 and 10 is definitely that, you know, genetic versus epigenetic effect, and I think, you know, the red and black kind of give a big disparity as far as what actually that scientific knowledge is, you know, as far as understanding that, you know, again, there is that environmental exposure, and, you know, again, even though you're twins, which, again, I happen to be one, it really does not have the same risk. So that's the issue, you know, with me and my family. I'm the youngest of 10 kids. I'm a twin, and of all the people in my family, I'm the one that got breast cancer. So it really just kind of highlights that it really doesn't matter what your genetics is. It really is kind of, you know, more, I think, related to environment and necessarily what happens in your lifetime. And then as my daughter gets ready to college and starts her own breast health screening, how can I make that change for her? So I think, you know, this is what we were looking at, is trying to look at the glass half full as we create in what we're describing as our window of opportunity. You know, we're looking at these windows of susceptibility and looking at these, you know, where we can try to impact change. So we're really trying to focus on the opportunity effect and capturing the age group, because again, as you look at the correct answers with the black line, there's definitely a dip as you go up to age, age 25. So we're kind of looking at, you know, adolescents not really, maybe not as interested, but not having the same working knowledge as far as scientific information. So I think this is where we have a definite window of opportunity to kind of capture that age group. And it kind of fits with our general mission for Pink Ribbon Girls, and that's the age group that we're already trying to target to make sure that we are definitely trying to impact their, you know, health and breast cancer risk. So looking at interest, you know, again, it's definitely that red is where we want to target. I think that's where we want to highlight a lot of our efforts. But the interesting thing is the age group, which is our pink, I don't know if it shows up very well. I'm not sure. Between the ages of 25 and 44, there's definitely an increased spiked interest. But again, I think that's representative of your childbearing years. You're now paying attention to that. But it also, again, creates that window of opportunity. But if we can get that interest started earlier, we actually can make that intrauterine exposure minimized and kind of look at those effects. So that's definitely one of our key elements to try and move forward with our outreach efforts and kind of hit those age groups as best we can. Now, looking at media, that was one of the things that we were trying to identify as we talked about understanding where our kids are electronically digitized and all that kind of stuff. I often tease my daughter. It's like, I have a smartphone, but I'm not sure really why they call it that. I'm not too smart when it comes to using that, so I just say, here, make it work for me. But this is where they want to hear. This is what vehicle they want to use. This is what they're driven to kind of capture that window. And again, everything needs to be in small sound bit type pieces because that's how they're getting all their information. So our purple bar, which represents that 14 to 24 age group, is really, you know, why we've kind of developed our YouTube videos and kind of have focused on that component, just because, again, it matches the age group that we want to hit, and it's definitely the vehicle that they, or that medium that they want to receive the information in. So that's kind of been our focus. So for all those who have their smartphones today, I'm going to give you a very busy slide. If you have not seen or heard about QR codes, there's a free application on your phones that you can download with a bar scanner. And with these QR codes, what it do is you'll scan this little box, and then it'll take you right into the website or the URL address or directly to our YouTube video. So it's instantaneous response and instantaneous information, which, again, we have issues with impulse control in today's society because they want things quickly and fast and all that kind of piece. So we're trying to, you know, feed that in a positive way and using that to our advantage when we're looking at outreach and education and things along those lines. So I'm a fast talker, so I've gone through, and I'm going to catch up where we are behind. But this has kind of been our team as far as with the University of Cincinnati. Again, you know, in getting support from Grown Up Female and Dr. Burrow's group and Dr. Penny, again, I just am grateful that as a Pink Ribbon Girl, as a very small, non-profit, grassroots organization, can get involved in this kind of direction and this kind of potential impact as we move forward and looking at environmental exposure. So it's just an exciting opportunity for us, and Tracy Metzger and I have just been thrilled to be involved and just proud to be able to kind of contribute in a very small manner. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.